Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center, and I'm so excited to have back on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, great to be with you again.
Good to hear you, John. And on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hi, listeners. Thanks for being in touch. We know sometimes you send us emails. We read them. Thanks for reaching out to us.
John, you've been on a little bit of a hiatus with the CD3 run.
Yeah, you know,
give
us
a quick summary.
Vacation?
Yeah, give us a quick summary. What was the experience like? What did you learn?
So it's running for Congress is an interesting experience. Congress is utterly broken. The political process is broken. People have lots of concerns, but I don't know if it was the fact that there were 27 different candidates or more. Not just in my race, but the Senate race, the governor's race, attorney general, auditor, and so forth. But, you know, delegates didn't fully engage like you would expect them to engage. And the electorate just seemed to be disengaged. I heard from a lot of folks, they just felt fatigue. Mm-hmm. And as you started to tease it out, a lot of people talk like they felt like they'd been in a presidential campaign for 8 years without a break.
A permanent campaign.
And they just feel fatigued and they're sick of politics.
So can you tell us again, what is the basic sort of geography of this district?
This district is basically southeastern Utah. So you can kind of think about Park City going east out to Uinta County, down to San Juan County. And then when you think about the Wasatch Front, you can think about the southeastern part of Salt Lake County, kind of Holiday, Midvale, Cottonwood Heights, basically following east of I-15 down into Utah County.
Yeah.
And then it kind of jogs over at about American Fork and then goes east of Utah Lake and then kind of takes the north part of Springville.
So when you were out talking to people, I'm assuming you went to every county, talked to people everywhere. Could you just give us a couple of highlights about, did you hear that people had really different concerns given small, like rural versus urban? Did you hear, like, did anything stand out to you in terms of what you were hearing from Utahns?
The strongest factor was Trump versus non-Trump. That seemed to be the litmus test. There were what I would call secondary issues, secure the border. But when you talk secure the border, they wanted to hear secure the border, and basically the president can do it by fiat, by executive order. If you wanted to get into what it costs to build the wall, what it costs to get additional personnel, what it costs to deal with asylum judges, what Congress needs to do, a lot of folks did not have the interest in diving into those level of details. The other thing through convention was there was a strong wing of isolationism, you know, kind of, you know, anti-Ukraine, anti-war in the Middle East, those type of issues.
Yeah. Well, we want to talk about the big news of the weekend and all, but just right before we do that, Celeste Molloy ahead by 214 votes. Looks like this is headed to a recount.
That's what it sounds like. It's going to go to a recount.
It doesn't get much closer than that, Shireen.
No, it doesn't. And I've been in some close races. I've been in a close race in particular. Yeah, but that was, it's stunning. It is, it's just a reminder to people. And I think your notion that people are fatigued really resonates with me. I think there's a lot of that for people on, from many political corners. But when you think about the fact that these races come down to, I mean, in this case, that is a handful of votes. If we're talking about a district that has over 700,000 people in it, right? Your vote really does matter. And I just really ask people to think about that. I do think it's sort of a sacred commitment that we have when we exercise that right.
So it's a big week for Republicans.
One of the challenges, though, here's the thing. I mean, I talk with folks that kind of voting is irrational because it takes so much time to be informed to then cast your vote. And that's why a lot of people, I think, feel like I don't have the time and just don't, or they just kind of vote for a name they recognize.
Yeah.
And it's difficult.
Take the time. Hey, it's going to be a big week for Republicans. The Republican National Convention is in Milwaukee. Wow, what a weekend with an assassination attempt of our former president. Nicks his ear, John.
Oh,
my goodness. Shireen,
and
I'm thinking,
looks like if he hadn't just turned his head just at that moment, it would have been a very tragic situation.
Yeah. And then for us to lose a volunteer firefighter, a father who lost his life in a political convention. Shireen, give us your initial reaction.
My initial reaction is that this kind of violence, unfortunately, has become quite commonplace in this country. It is uncommon in these high profile political settings. But when we think about gun violence in our streets, in our schools, when we think about the number of people who choose to end their own lives by guns, there is a deep problem, right? And I would say, I feel terrible about this. And mm-hmm. I'm struggling with the calls that are saying there's no space for violence in our politics. It feels like there's been a lot of space for violence in our politics. And I'm unhappy about that.
Yeah, look
I'm
in
ashamed.
The mirror.
I'm ashamed about that.
Attacks about folks on the left and the right.
And the right, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think about the, you know, plotted kidnapping and assassination plot for Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, or the fact that Nancy Pelosi's husband was bludgeoned with a hammer. Like, this is happening on the right mm-hmm. and the left. And I think it is unacceptable, but unfortunately it is who we are. And I'm worried that we're headed into a more violent time. And I would just ask people to really think about where it is that you engage and how we might make different moves to be kinder, mm-hmm. To create more safety for people, in the political realm and beyond.
John, 20-year-old Thomas Matthew Crooks wakes up, gets an AR-15, climbs up on top of a rooftop, and tries to assassinate a political candidate. You can't make this stuff up.
No. And people are wanting to know why. Why mm-hmm. did he do it? What I'm hearing right now is nobody has any indication. He didn't really leave any clues or any manifesto or anything that said why he was going to do this. And you look and say, yeah, 20 years old.
Yeah.
And somehow, with all the security and everything else like that, was able to take those shots.
Yeah. Shereen, what did you make of the president spontaneously, you know, clenching his fist as he's being taken off the stage and saying, fight,
yeah.
fight?
Yeah. I mean, I have long believed that he is a performer. And I do feel like that moment will be, I mean, forever blazed into my memory and certainly for others. And to start chanting fight, I think, is the antithesis of what we need in this moment. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it speaks to a bit of what is appealing about Trump's character for people, right? Mm-hmm. The sense of...
He's a fighter. Street fighter.
And that, yeah, I don't know. What did you think?
Oh, boy. I was deeply saddened by the moment. I texted to my kids, this is bad, bad for our country.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that he was not hit.
And killed. Me too.
And, fight wouldn't have been the first words out of my mouth. But.
What would they have been? I mean, I can see the visceral reaction
mm-hmm.
of, yeah, you're not going to take me out.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think performative. I just think for a lot of folks, that's the natural response is I'm going to keep fighting.
Yeah. I'd be more in the God bless America kind of category. Just somewhere where I'd be like, we can do better. You know, this is not appropriate.
Well, and like at that moment, you don't know what is happening. Like, again, who knows, whatever. But like, I'm thinking my instinct would be like, get down. Like, everybody be down. Get down. Mm-hmm. But that was not I don't know.
We're recording this on Monday. The president's speaking tonight. But he's picked J.D. Vance as his VP candidate. John, give us your reaction to that.
Well,
a senator from Ohio. Am I remembering this right?
Yeah. Been in there for a couple of years.
Doesn't sound like a lot of experience.
Made fame with his Hillbilly Elegy book, Yale Law School graduate and stuff. So a smart guy. But, you know, I from my perspective, I look and see he doesn't seem to bring much to the ticket. I mean, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Marco Rubio seem to bring much more to the ticket. Yet Trump picked J.D. Vance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shereen.
Yeah, I don't think Ohio's in play, so it's not necessarily a good move for that, right, mm-hmm. when we're thinking about expanding. J.D. Vance is an interesting character, has certainly run the gamut on positions on Trump himself, right, at a point saying that he was quite dangerous for this country, and then ultimately becoming, I would say, just a really first-class sycophant for Donald Trump. I worry about somebody with such little experience, truly, being second in line to the presidency when we think about the violence that we just saw, or the fact that as much as we want to talk about Biden's age, Trump is not far behind. Mm-hmm. I do not think that this is a person who is qualified to step in as our president. But I don't think that matters, because I do think that this has become about a cult of personality. And in fact, Trumpism is about something bigger than Donald Trump himself. Which is why I think these kind of like what Trump does in the next few days, I don't know that it matters.
Yeah.
Because I think the course has been set.
It strikes me that he's making a loyalty pick.
Yes.
And not a qualification pick.
Or strategy.
Well, and one of the key things, if you will, is I think Vance sings or resonates with the working class, you know, Rust Belt kind of voter.
Who As a feels, Harvard grad?
Well, I mean, just but asking. What he grew up and therefore speaks and resonates with them who feel like the Democratic Party has left them behind and feels like the new incarnation of the Republican Party is where they fit.
Yeah.
And so as from my perspective, as you see more populism taking place and folks that are feeling like the system's rigged against them, the system's stacked, you know.
Shireen, I have not been with you for a while, but where do you stand on Biden getting out of the race?
Oh, Biden was, I think listeners know, Biden was not my first choice. I have actually been
second
or third choice either. I have been moved by his compassion. I do think that he is a person who is fundamentally the most probably progressive president that we've had when we think about things that matter a lot to me, expanding access to healthcare, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, taking decisive moves on our environment, really working to bolster the middle class. And I know we can have disagreements about this, but the investments in infrastructure, the investments in bringing jobs here, the CHIPS Act, all of those things really fundamentally, I think, have benefited the American people and will continue to do so. I believe that he is supremely positioned to be a great second-term president. I do not believe that he is supremely positioned to be a great candidate. And that is tough. Mm-hmm. I think you can be great at the job of the presidency and not be ready to have this fight.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think he should be stepping down and that he should be offering his services to be a senior advisor to the next candidate. Then we get the best of both worlds. John, we have 30 more seconds. Your quick reaction to Biden staying in the race.
If I were a Democrat, I'd be looking for him to get out. But I get that they're kind of stuck of who do we pick at this late time frame. I'd be really irritated when I seem to recall he said he's going to be a one-term president.
I don't think he ever said that. He said he was transitional.
I think transitional, but yeah. I think a lot of people believe that was one term to block Trump and then hand it off to the next generation.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I don't know to what extent you've talked about this, but when you look at the abysmal performance at the debate, which takes the uncertainty that lots of Americans had about his age and capabilities, and all of a sudden it was front and center and undeniable, and largely hasn't been able to rebut that since, causes a lot of folks.
Undeniable. I'm with you, John.
Undeniable.
Yeah, I'm with
you.
Yeah.
Hey, in our next segment, we're going to talk about President Zelensky's visit to Salt Lake City. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner, I'm in the political center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. Okay, Secret Service, Salt Lake City, President Zelensky in town.
Yes.
I got to kind of watch this play out at Grand America Hotel. My, the security was intense. You couldn't park underneath the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of thinking about it in my mind, and then I'm realizing how anywhere he goes, he's under such threat.
Yes.
I think, right?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And it was such a, it was so, really, I mean, speaks to the prominence of our state that we're hosting a National Governors Association meeting. And we have a head of state of a country that's so important right now, Ukraine, in our midst, sharing his message.
So
it's really cool.
So tell us why the president of Ukraine would be speaking here to governors.
Yeah. Well, I think the key is that the NATO conference was happening in D.C. That brought him to our country. So he addressed NATO.
Yeah.
And then Utah, bless our heart, has done more for Ukraine than any state. I'm absolutely convinced of that. This is Deloy Hansen's philanthropy. This is Gail Miller family's philanthropy. This is the LDS Church's philanthropy.
We forget there's a lot of Utahns that have strong connections.
Yeah, and it
showed.
I have
neighbors that have strong connections, LDS missions and so forth.
It was just to acknowledge that, Shireen.
Yeah.
And so he came and as a favor to Governor Cox as he's hosting the NGA. And in typical fashion, he's in his, you know, army-colored gear and comes out with that accent and gives an update on the war. And essentially, when Governor Cox introduced him, he said, I'll just introduce him by saying his famous quote, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition.
Yeah.
That's the President Zelensky we've come to know.
Right.
Yeah. Did you get to or read anything about this? Any reactions?
No, I mean, clearly he is going anywhere he can to build support to help for the war. And so he is willing to go and encourage and beg and plead and make the case why Ukraine fighting Russia is so critical, not just to Ukrainians, but to the world as a whole. And so
he brought his wife with him, Olena Zelenska. And she hosted a 30-40 person lunch.
And you say that uniquely. Explain why you pronounce that slightly
just
different.
Just the feminine, I guess, yeah. In Ukrainian, Zelenska.
Yeah, so the last names are feminized for women.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what an impressive woman. And she has a foundation that is all about, servicing these people that have been so hurt by this war. They're a power couple. Pretty cool. To see him in our town, and then to see Governor Cox turn over the gavel from a year of service and his Disagree Better initiative. I got to see him in front of his peers, quite respected. He turns the gavel over to the governor of Colorado.
Yeah.
But it's neat to see our governor in a leadership role.
So I know that this happened before this weekend, but we've talked a bit about kind of the tensions around Disagree Better, right? The notion that we fundamentally, I think, all of us here agree that this is a great initiative, but sometimes see not as much gusto, perhaps, when it comes to committing to this in the way that we're speaking to each other here in our own state, or the disagreements that we get into here in the state.
Well, it's hard to engage.
It's hard to engage. And that it sometimes feels easier, right, when it's maybe a state removed or when we're thinking about things kind of across greater divides. But I'm wondering, what did you hear there that maybe listeners can think about? Because we've talked, quite extensively about certainly the Dignity Index. And I think as we're kind of thinking about the moment that we're in right now, we do have an opportunity to either, I think, move towards a much more violent future or to say as a citizenry, enough. Mm-hmm. This is not where we want to go. And I think the Dignity Index, the, notions like Disagree Better give us clues about how to get there. Mm-hmm. What did you hear?
I mean, the main thing I took away was that Governor Cox is viewed as a leader among his peers, and that the type of leadership he brings is a collaborative leadership, a hopeful leadership. He, our producers put quotes in our sheet here about how he says, "I'm not optimistic about, the future of our country." And he's basically saying that because optimism is just like a feeling where hope is an action.
Yeah.
And I got to see Governor Cox be very forceful about how we need to take responsibility to put our country where it needs to be. And that was neat to see his leadership in that way.
Yeah.
So that's fun. Hey.
Well, and the Disagree Better comes from Arthur Brooks' book, Love Your Enemies.
Yeah.
And if you step back to the bigger picture of what Arthur talked about, how much do you love your enemies?
Yeah.
Think about that. It's a hard, hard concept. To say, I love my enemy. Doesn't mean I'm going to agree with them on anything, but I love them and disagree better. Yes, we need to engage in disagreement. We need to do it better. But you still have to, you have to have something that you might lose in that disagreement.
Yeah.
If you have nothing to lose, it doesn't matter.
John, I think of it as that love and dignity are inherent in the human soul, the worth of the soul.
Yeah.
And then you disagree after that. Mm-hmm. But hey, Mike Lee, Shireen, on his personal X account, has said some, tweeted out some things about the shooting that I thought were...
X'd out?
X'd out, yeah.
Anyway, how would you characterize this for our listeners?
Well, so I just found this one to be pretty disturbing. I think in the wake of, certainly the assassination attempt and thinking about just increasing violence generally, I appreciate that. I do think Trump and others have said we really do need to take the temperature down. And I guess Lee later said that. But initially, I feel like the tweet, and this may have been the first one, said this would happen a lot less if we didn't make the federal government and the presidency so ridiculously powerful. And then he went on to say, let's push power back to where it belongs. He added, we need government control, not gun control. Otherwise, tribalism advances at the national level. So as a person who I perceive as being deeply engaged in tribalism, I find that rich. But additionally, I would say, for Lee to say something like that, for me, from where I sit, the things I care about, the way that I feel like I see our country going, when I see things like we need government control, not gun control, just that notion of government control is really hitting me in a way that feels threatening, really dangerous. And I was curious about it. And so I actually asked John, as my Republican interpreter, what does this mean?
Pull out the decoder ring. What does it say?
Because I do think that when I read this, I think there's a version of a future where opinions like mine have greater consequences in this country. That's right. How I read right. it.
And the way I read it, and I don't know, I haven't talked with him, but the way I read it is he's really trying to talk about a concept called federalism. And he's concerned that there's too much power at the federal level. And it's high stakes. I mean, we're looking right now, Trump or Biden, who's going to be president and who's going to destroy the country and yada, yada, yada. And I think what he's trying to say, perhaps inartfully, is if we push a bunch of that back down to the local level, the states, the communities, we wouldn't have this high stake tribalism at the federal level. We wouldn't have this fighting back and forth and potentially even the threats of violence out there if we would push so much of that back down. I think that's what he's trying to say.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, John, I need your read on the Supreme Court's ruling. It was unanimous that the Utah Constitution guarantees citizens the right to change their government through ballot initiatives, and they basically supported the gerrymandering case.
Yeah, so what they said is when Utahns exercise their right to reform the government through a citizen initiative, that right is protected from government infringement.
Hands off, legislature.
Constitutionally protected from unfettered legislative amendment, repeal, or replacement. Legislative changes that facilitate or support the reform, or at least do not impair it, do not implicate the people's rights. But legislative changes that do impair the reform can only survive constitutional challenge if they're narrowly tailored to advance a compelling government interest, what we call strict scrutiny. And so from a legislative perspective, this is really broad and expansive. Because from a legislative perspective, we look at statute, and statute, nothing sacred about statute. It gets changed every year. And so therefore, an initiative changes statute, and so it's subject to being changed. So all of a sudden to say, no, there's something special about this part of statute, unlike these other parts of statute, mm-hmm. and it essentially rises to somewhat the level of a constitutional issue.
So a group of Utahns don't like how the state is redistricting. They form an initiative, pass, forms better boundaries. They come up with their maps. Take it from here, Shireen.
Yep. So the legislature said, cute, you can go ahead and have your nonpartisan committee go around the state, collect feedback, understand some of the core principles that like communities shouldn't be unnecessarily divided up, communities of color, like there were many different considerations for how maps should be drawn and where lines should be drawn. And they took all of that into account and went around the state and had feedback sessions and then submitted a set of maps. And the legislature said, cute, here are our maps. We are choosing to divide, again, Salt Lake County into all four congressional districts. We'll be divided here in this county, our most populous county, and our second bluest county. I think that's right. Summit County, I think, leans more Democrat. So this one's cut into four pieces. And really, then what people said was that was a violation of what the citizens passed. The citizens said, we want to be able to pick our politicians, not the other way around, that Utah politicians shouldn't be able to draw the lines to their benefit. And they did. And that's what.
And boy, did the legislature bite back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Give us the take from a legislative mind here, John.
Well, I think from a legislative mind, they're looking at this one saying, now you've created two different levels of statute, one that's more privileged than the other. And two, I think the legislature looks and says the Supreme Court went off the rails. They went way too far in terms of what they did. Now, this is just one first ruling. Then it got kicked back down to lower courts, and they're going to work through
next?
It.
So what happens next is I do believe that it'll go through the process of now the courts will determine if the bill that actually changed the process by which the maps were selected, which was the legislature putting it back in their hands, whether or not now that basically violates Utah statute.
To what extent it was in line with the reform and to what extent it was contrary to the reform. And if it was contrary,
we may get new maps.
Did it meet strict scrutiny?
Yeah. And likelihood is it wasn't narrow enough, and so it won't meet the test and we'll have new boundaries for the 2026 campaign.
Potentially.
Wow.
And new camp, you know, new boundaries.
Yeah.
Congressional, state Senate, state House, state school board.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
That's all in flux, though. So the next piece. So then now the preceding court case will determine that.
Now the other thing that comes into play is when it comes to initiatives, to what extent? And I think there's some valid concern here. To what extent does it become like California, where there's lots of initiatives that are being pushed out there to override the legislature there? You know, is that going to happen here as well? And so there's the legislature is very concerned with that.
Sure. I would also just say when you talk about, you know, one being more privileged than the other, when you think about the amount of work that goes into getting these ballot initiatives on the ballot, is it 128,000 signatures from every county? Like the barrier to entry for these kinds of initiatives in our state is particularly high. The cost of these initiatives can be, it's certainly over $2 million. It's probably getting closer now to $10 million. So when we think about why maybe these should be different, I would just suggest that there is a much more difficult gauntlet that these kinds of initiatives are going through than we're seeing A, in other states, or B, a significant amount of legislation that we see coming out of our own
pass,
government.
Hey, not,
more
veto.
To come. Great discussion with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.